It happens to lots of people, realizing that a food you like or a drink you enjoy is just not good for you and you have to give it up. But a whole class of foods, that's a tough one. It happened to our guest this hour. Paul Graham enjoyed a lot of food and drink containing wheat, but over time his body showed the strain of trying to process what wheat contains. And with a confirmed diagnosis of celiac disease, wheat went out of the picture. It left a void. A void he writes about in his book, In Memory of Bread. Paul Graham teaches English at St. Lawrence University near his home in upstate New York. He got two of his food essays into the Best Food Writing Anthology in 2012 and 2013. Paul Graham, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. So you'd gotten up to respectability in food writing, which tells me you're fairly serious about food. You like what you're, I mean, you're pretty comprehensive about the stuff you put into your body.
I guess I am, and I also think that it's fascinating to write about and to explore the history of, so all those things come together.
Did you ever work as a chef or anything along those lines?
I did not. I actually have a theory that I probably would have been kicked out of culinary school or cooking school just because I like to color outside the lines, and I don't know, I don't respond very well to people yelling in my face, which seems to be the model.
I was going to say, you were watching too much Gordon Ramsay or something.
Yeah, maybe.
So do you... When you say you want to like to color outside the lines, you like to take some risks with food preparation?
Yeah, you know, when I cook something, I'll consult a cookbook a couple of times and, you know, memorize the steps in the process to the best of my ability. And then, you know, if I'm lacking something or if I need to make a substitution or I just feel like turning something up or turning something else down, I'll go ahead and do it and just see how it works out.
Usually it does, you say?
Yeah, usually it does.
All right, we'll ask about the mistakes later in the hour. Clearly a devotee of food, though. I mean, how much of your diet was wheat-based by your estimation?
Oh, gosh, that's a difficult estimate to make. I mean, I was eating a lot of bread because we were baking a lot of bread at home. As I write in the book, a couple of our friends had discovered a cookbook that was very popular at the time, and I think it still is in some circles, called Artisan Bread in 5 Minutes a Day. And it has a very alluring premise, which is that you mix up this dough and you keep it in a tub in your fridge, and whenever a loaf sounds good, you take it out, you shape it, you let it rise, and it goes right into the oven. And I wanted bread a lot, I guess, and you know, I ate a lot of pasta. I was brewing beer with a friend of mine. We had decided that we were going to become pretty devoted home brewers. We were going to become completely self-sufficient in the beer department, by which we meant, you know, to have a mix of seasonally appropriate brews. It takes a long time to brew beer, and certain varieties, it takes a longer time to age it. So by the time my diagnosis came down, we had about 20, 25 gallons of beer in the house in some stage of the process. So I don't know, maybe a third, 40% of the calories I was taking in involved gluten in some way.
Wow.
But that's actually not all that unusual, especially in Western countries.
Well, and as you point out in the book, it's not as simple as like, okay, well, you know, eat this and not that. I mean, there's a lot of a culture and humanity in our meals beyond just, you know, measuring calories and things like that.
Yeah, I never really was concerned about calories or... you know, the low-carbohydrate diet or something like that. As I say in the book, I didn't know that wheat could actually be a problem for anybody until somebody, one of my students maybe a colleague, mentioned that they had celiac disease, and I had never even heard of it. And when I was diagnosed with celiac disease, I was the first person in my family and the first in my my set of friends, really, to have that diagnosis. I met other people in time. But it was a really bewildering thing to experience because, you know, I had been eating homemade pasta and pastry and bread and drinking beer that we brewed with friends. So it definitely was a blow.
Wow. So 20, 25 gallons, you said, in the house and some form of production on the beer end. And you couldn't drink a drop of it, essentially, right?
I know. I gave it all to my co-brewer.
Wow.
I had to.
The first chapter is something like food porn. I mean, you were talking about the artisan bread. Your wife is the one who did most of the bread baking, is that right?
Yeah, she is. She is. And there was a telling thing there, which was that, you know, I didn't mind making the bread, but whenever I handled wheat flour, it made my hands break out. And that was one of the early signs that there was an intolerance in me. I just didn't put it together. So she was the one who did all of the baking. And yeah, we shared a lot of those loaves with friends, and you know, enjoyed it very much.
Sometimes you ate like a loaf a day. Is that what happened with you personally?
Sometimes I would on a good day, yeah. but these are small loaves. These are not like the, 18-inch loaves that you get from the grocery store. Maybe the size of a small melon or something like that, mm-hmm. because homemade bread doesn't have any of the additives to it that increase elasticity and shelf life. So it paid to make a smaller loaf and enjoy it in a day when it was still fresh rather than let it go stale.
So I'm curious, the part about knowing some noticing some irritation on your hands,
yeah.
what did you chalk that up to at the time? Did you seek medical help for just that part?
I did. It actually happened about 10 years before I was diagnosed. And I went to a dermatologist who misdiagnosed me. He said that I had eczema. And he prescribed topical steroids, which I used. It was very inconvenient because you were just keeping this goop on your digits all day. And sometimes it went away and sometimes it didn't. I later learned that this is a condition called dermatitis herpetiformis, which is usually an early harbinger of celiac disease. It shows that your body is reacting to gluten. Some people, that's all they experience when they have celiac disease, but other people, it presages the intestinal difficulties that are to come.
You mean some people can actually get the skin outbreak but not get the intestinal stuff?
Yeah, that's true.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, we learn a lot in this book. It is called In Memory of Bread. It's a memoir by Paul Graham, who teaches English at St. Lawrence University. He had to say goodbye to a lot of foods that he loves, food and drink, we should point out, with the beer production. We'll come back and talk more with Paul about all the things that he's had to change over in his life and all the steps that led up to the actual diagnosis of celiac disease. It was not a fun process by any stretch of the imagination. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange, talk more to Paul Graham, and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Paul Graham. He teaches English at St. Lawrence University in upstate New York, and he's written a book about his farewell to wheat, essentially. He came down with celiac disease, or developed celiac disease, and had to give up most everything involving wheat, not just a few. His book is called In Memory of Bread, a memoir. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Maybe you have some experiences to share in this department, having to change your diet because of some condition or another. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Paul, you talked about being something like self-sufficient with beers. What was what the hope was, that you would be able to provide all your own beer. Is this part of the green hedonism you write about in the book?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, the term.
Just a funny term that I tried to come up with to justify the brewing that we were doing. But the thing is, different varieties have to age for, you know, sometimes 6, 7, 8 months in order to really round out. So you have to have other things that you're making and aging and drinking for shorter periods of time in between. So that was how that happened.
With the amount of beer you were brewing and trying to store, I mean, do you have a 2-car garage, 3-car garage?
No, we have a 1-car garage, but we have a walk-in pantry, and my co-brewer brought some back to his place, so we found room for it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you mentioned the irritation with the hands,
yeah.
and that had been a long time before things started to get bad in your guts. What were the indications in your guts that things were starting to go wrong?
Well, it's the usual typical GI symptoms, diarrhea, bloating, that kind of thing. It had flared up throughout my 30s, and I just thought that it was a periodic infection that I sometimes got because my doctor would prescribe antibiotics, and every time it went away. So when I got that sick, it was a familiar feeling to me, and I thought, okay, I'll go back into the doctor, and he'll give me some Cipro, and that'll clear it right out. Interestingly, I never asked, and he never asked why this kept coming around, and this time it didn't work. The symptoms stayed, and they actually got worse. And I went back, and he said, okay, well, we'll try another antibiotic, and that didn't work. And we went back, and I tried another antibiotic, And this entire time, what's happening is, you know, when you have celiac disease, it's an autoimmune disorder, and the body's immune system attacks healthy intestinal tissue and basically compromises its ability to absorb nutrients from food. And if it goes on long enough, the intestines or the little projections in the intestines that absorb food can atrophy. So I was basically absorbing no nutrients at all, and I was stubbornly clinging to my routine. You know, I was continuing to go to work, I was continuing to do chores, walk the dog, all of that stuff, and the weight just fell off of me really, really fast.
Which I can imagine got you thinking that it was cancer.
That's exactly what my doctor said. He didn't diagnose celiac disease. He didn't say he suspected celiac disease. When he ran out of antibiotics that he could try, he called the hospital and tried to order up a CT scan to take a look at my gut. The insurance company turned it down, and he said that he asked for that scan because he was worried about tumors. And when it was turned down, he said, okay, we're just going to have to wait and see what happens next.
Given as hard as your doctor tried to find something, an answer for what was wrong with you, but wasn't really looking at celiac disease, it makes me wonder if celiac is that rare or if there's a lot of denial about it.
It's not all that. I mean, it is and it isn't rare. The estimates are that it affects about 3 million Americans, 1 in 133 to 1 in 142, depending upon whose numbers you use. Celiac disease is actually believed to be the most common autoimmune disorder in the world, and it affects more people than epilepsy affects, rheumatoid arthritis. But it's also a very tricky disease, I think, autoimmune disorder to diagnose, because over 300 symptoms have been associated with celiac disease, according to some estimates. A lot of them cluster around gut problems. But it's also frequently misdiagnosed as chronic fatigue syndrome or irritable bowel syndrome or colitis or something like that. And for that reason, the average time to diagnosis in this country is about 4 years, which is a long time to be suffering if you think about it.
That really is. There's no easy test, no, you're positive, you got celiac?
Well, now there is a blood test, yes, and it is pretty easy. You have to be consuming gluten in order to do it. But I think that I was probably right at the tail end of, what would you call it, a generation or a cohort of people who have celiac disease at a time when it was not as well known. I think that, you know, even within the last 3 or 4 years, more and more people are learning about celiac disease, primarily through the popularity of the gluten-free diet, I think.
A lot of GF stuff out there.
A lot of people eat GF by choice, but, you know, the people who don't eat GF by choice say, I do it because I have this. And I think that that's helped to raise the awareness some. And I don't think it's simply because I'm paying attention to celiac disease now that I feel like it's more, that it's more widely known.
Yeah,
but at the time, and especially in rural areas, I have to stress that, too. I live in a pretty rural part of upstate New York. And, you know, if only, 1 to 2% of the population in the country has it, then it's going to be much less common where I am.
Paul Graham's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book about discovering and coming to grips with celiac disease is called In Memory of Bread. I'm still surprised at the numbers of kinds of food that you wouldn't think would be an issue for somebody with celiac disease. And I'm impressed that you're eating Rogue Creamery cheese. It's made about 15 miles from where I sit. But why would cut cheeses be involved in celiac disease?
Well, in certain cheeses, not all blue cheeses are made this way, but some blue cheeses are made with an inoculation of mold that comes from bread. So that goes into the cheese, and you get gluten on the bread.
Ah, okay. So you give us quite a couple of good history lessons in here, and we've depended on grains essentially as long as there have been human beings, haven't we?
Not as long as there have been human beings, but at least for the last 10,000 years or so. The Neolithic Revolution, which is the farming revolution that led to a lot of the things that we associate with civilization, artwork, building structures, farming, war, eventually all those things, that was enabled by the ability to harvest and bank and store grain. So it's one of the most important things that has happened to human beings, I think, in recent history, for sure.
How long and ugly is the history of diseases that come from bread and grains?
Well, it's ugly, and it's pretty long. There's evidence of celiac disease stretching back to about 100 AD. The historical record seems to be accurate on this. There was a physician named Areteus, who a Greek physician from Cappadocia, who kept records on his patients and described pretty much exactly what celiac disease is and does and looks like in his patients. And there's reason to believe, I think, that it's been part of the human experience for, all the time in between as well. And the research into it and the identification of it was resurrected in the 19th century when a London pediatrician by the name of Samuel Gee came across Areteus' writings. He was able to read Greek. And he connected some of what this ancient Greek physician was writing about and seeing with the patients that he was seeing in his own hospital. The interesting thing about the history of doctors and their experience with celiac disease is that bread was very often the last thing that they suspected. Samuel Gee, for instance, allowed his patients very thin slices of toast. There were a lot of things that he swapped out of their diets, but he didn't remove bread. And this seems to be a constant, and it was interesting to me that it was a constant in my own experience as well, that for as sick as I got, I continued to allow myself to eat bread because bread is bread. It's harmless.
It's the staff of life still.
It's the staff of life, yes. It's essential. And that's a really interesting thread in the history of that disease.
Paul Graham's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called In Memory of Bread. It's about coming to grips with celiac disease. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. You might have questions for him about the procedures he went through or maybe some stories to share of your own with food allergies. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. So different times of the emergency room, you did spend some overnights in the hospital. And at one point, a friend brings you beef broth in the hospital. Was that a bit of a revelation?
Well, it was the first time that I had eaten something that wasn't toxic to me, and it really tasted good. One of the interesting things, too, is that even when I was in the hospital, because gluten, it's not just wheat, it's gluten, which is found in barley and spelt and rye, was potentially lurking in some of the things that I was fed in the hospital. It's not in all bouillon cubes, but it can be in some of them. And it certainly was in the sandwich that they brought me one day when I was near the end of my stay. When my friend brought me broth, it was kind of revelation because it was the first thing that I tasted and wanted more of because it was the first thing that I had enjoyed probably in four to five weeks.
Did your friend have to sneak it into the hospital or something? I can't imagine somebody there on a restrictive diet is going to have the doctor go, oh, sure, whatever you want to bring in from outside.
I think she did. I was pretty out of it because I had been sedated for the procedures, and I was terribly anemic at that time. My iron count was so low that I needed blood transfusions before they would do the endoscopy and the colonoscopies to try to figure out what was wrong with me. So even now, I reconstructed it to the best of my ability, and I stand by what I've reconstructed. But there are moments where. I can't remember, for instance, how she got it in. She may have just carried it in briefly. I don't know.
So are there degrees of celiac disease, Paul? I mean, you mentioned barley, spelt, rye, and wheat. That's not all grains. I mean, can some sufferers eat oats, for example?
Some sufferers can eat oats, yeah. For a lot of people, the problem with oats is that they're processed in a facility that also processes wheat. Cross-contamination is an issue for someone with celiac disease, and I think a lot of people don't understand that. The estimate is that about an eighth of a teaspoon is enough to really knock someone sideways. An eighth of a teaspoon of wheat flour or an eighth of a teaspoon of some gluten-containing substance is enough to really do damage to a person with celiac disease that they can feel it. I happen to be one of the unlucky few, I guess you could say, whose immune system responds to the protein in oats exactly like it responds to the protein in gluten or the gluten protein.
Wow, and an eighth of a teaspoon. When you think about the fact that the smallest measuring device in most kitchens is a quarter of a teaspoon, and it's just half of that. That's not much at all.
You can put it in this perspective too. It's about a 48th of a slice of sandwich bread.
A 48th of a slice.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. So if you can cut it up that thin, you've got some serious knife skills. A 48th.
So there's a moment here where you've already gotten the diagnosis of celiac. It's like okay, I got to deal with this. But it's almost like you wanted to, I don't know. There was a level of vengeance or something in you. You decided for a final meal with gluten. What was that?
That remains one of the dumbest things I think I've done. I decided right after I got diagnosed that I was going to go and get myself a Reuben at the local hotel restaurant. For reasons that I still don't understand, I was really craving one the entire time that I was sick. I think I was just eating bland food, so I wanted a flavor bomb or something like that. And I just decided that I was going to suffer through one last encounter with it. I didn't think the damage could get much worse than it already was. So without telling my wife, I'll add, I got into the car and drove to the hotel and ordered a sandwich and ate it in the car. And it did exactly what I thought it would do to me. It made me feel really sick.
Oh, I bet. So how long before? I mean, when you would get something, and I guess to this day probably still once in a while get something in you, I mean, how long does it take to feel normal again?
It depends upon how bad it is. You know, usually a couple of days for me to completely get around the corner from it. Sometimes I get sick right after I get some gluten in my system just because I think my immune system's out of whack generally. I've developed some survival strategies in the sense that, you know, if I know that something has gotten me, what I'll usually do is go for a run and try to sweat it out and then drink as much water as I possibly can, but that's provided that I'm actually healthy enough to be able to do that. I actually have not had that many encounters, in the recent past, and part of it is because we don't have any wheat or gluten in our house at all. My wife is gluten-free with me. And also because my friends are really, really careful. It's one of the cooler things that the disease has given me, I guess you could say, just that level of awareness and support and fellowship among my friends. Just about everybody has my back, which is really nice.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing in the case of your wife. As you point out, this is not something you would have asked of her, and she just did it.
Yeah, she did. I don't know what to say except that she loves me and she's great like that.
Paul Graham is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Let's take a call. Here is Michelle in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. His book is In Memory of Bread. Michelle, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I nearly died from gluten. I had a cardiac arrest and the outer sac of my lungs were all swollen and it was all caused by gluten.
Oh, my gosh. That is the first and most severe reaction that I've heard of like that.
And how long before you, what'd they have to do to get you back?
Pardon?
What'd they have to do to get you back back to health?
They had to aspirate out the fluid from my lungs. And then they thought it would just go away, but it just stayed. And so eventually they diagnosed me with lupus, but that was the symptom.
So what, had you eaten something in particular? Had you not been eating gluten up to that point? What happened there?
I ate like everybody else. I just ate whatever I wanted. But I was very lucky that right after I was in the hospital, a doctor said to me, you should stop gluten. And I didn't pay attention to her. But a few weeks later, she asked me about it, and she said, you have got be off of gluten. And within a week, I knew that it was it. That was the cause.
It's amazing, and it's absolutely incredible just how much better you feel and how quickly you feel it if your body is reacting to it as if it were a toxin. That's not the case for everybody, I realize, but for people who have celiac disease or who have other medical conditions that are improved when they eliminate it, it's life-changing. It's incredible.
Michelle, thanks for the input. Paul, via Facebook, he's in Grants Pass, wants to know if, actually Robert in Grants Pass, sorry, wants to know if you, Paul, can drink gluten-free beer.
I can. There's several varieties out there. Some of them are not very good. Some of them are quite good. And then there's also this new field of beer, this new type of beer known as gluten-reduced beer, which I write about in the book. Omission Brewing in Portland is one of them, and also Stone Brewing in California is another maker of this gluten-reduced beer. People who react to gluten have to be very careful with them. I don't have them as often as I would like to, that's for sure. But what these breweries are doing is they're essentially using an agent that clarifies the beer, and in the process of clarifying, it also strips down the gluten to non-toxic levels, right around 10 to 20 parts per million. So those are the ones that I really enjoy, but there are many others out there that are also pretty good, and then there are some that are not very good at all.
So 10 to 20 parts per million, about how many parts can you take in a day of gluten?
Well, the studies indicate that 20 parts per million is safe for somebody who has celiac disease, but I think if you push a lot of doctors and researchers, they'll say, you know, zero is preferable. But, you know, if I have one of those, I never have experienced any ill effects from it. So, and I'm a Geiger counter for gluten, so I have to think that I would have experienced something if it were toxic to me.
We'll talk more with Paul Graham about his book, In Memory of Bread, his experiences with celiac disease and going gluten-free. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Graham and your phone calls and emails in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Paul Graham. He teaches English at St. Lawrence University in upstate New York. He's written a book about his experience with celiac disease and having to change to an entirely gluten-free diet, or nearly completely gluten-free. The book is called In Memory of Bread, a memoir. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. You might have questions about what he went through or some experiences to share of your own about things you went through if you had a similar situation with certain kinds of foods you can't eat. It does happen. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Talk about then the process of changing over the house. It sounds like you and your wife really kind of went after the kitchen cabinets and the pantry and started just taking out all the foods you could no longer eat.
Yeah, we did. We waited a little while, I think, because there was a period where I was just basically only eating clear liquids while my stomach learned to redigest things. But yeah, once that was done, all the flour, all the crackers, all the cereals, the oats, the soy sauce, the other sauces, the breadcrumbs, the panko, you name it, if it had gluten in it, it went out the door. And then we had to sanitize things like the toaster because there were crumbs left in that, of course. We put the pasta machine away forever, as it turned out. And we had to clean off pots and pans and the cast iron skillet. And, yeah, it was a process.
Wow. It sounds like it really is sanitizing, as you point out. Yeah.
Yeah, because when such a small amount can make you sick and you're trying to recover, you know, it would have been easier to throw some of those things out, but at the same time, you know, they're gifts from friends and wedding gifts, and you've had them for a long time, and you have these pots and other tools, you know, their tendencies, you develop relationships with them. It's hard to let go. It's easier to just clean them and hang on to them.
So that's home. Now at the grocery store, that must be an interesting situation. You muse about walking past the Oreos and Trix boxes. I'm going to guess you weren't a big consumer of those items beforehand.
I wasn't. I mean, that's the weird thing about it. It's like, you know, you walk into the grocery store after a diagnosis like that, and the first thing that you perceive is that entire zones of it are just off limits. Like, you have no business anymore for the rest of your life in that aisle. but, you know, at the same time, you begin to think, okay, well, I didn't go down that aisle very much anyway. Like, when was the last time I ate a Malamar? I can't remember, right? And then you think, but yeah, I always had the option to eat a Malamar. That's the thing. That's the thing that matters, right? Yeah, so it was a bit of a shock, and, you know, I think as is the case with a lot of rural grocery stores, our local store does what it can, and we've got a great food co-op not too far away, which turned out to be the place for us to go. But, you know, if you're in a rural environment, if you're not, you know, near a huge grocery store with a lot of buying power or something like that, the options are limited. And I'll also add they're about 250% more expensive than their conventional counterparts, and they're about half as delicious some of the time.
Sorry, that was the next question, then, was yeah. If there have been some revelations along the way about things you went, oh, well, this is a pleasant surprise, or if there was a lot of hit and miss in the beginning.
There was a lot of hit and miss in the beginning. And, of course, the hardest things to make behave like wheat are rice breads, you know, breads made out of rice or tapioca or sorghum or something like that. I'll get to that in a second. I mean, there's a lot of good crackers out there. There's some pancake mixes that are really pretty good. Ultimately, what I ended up doing was leaving those things behind for the most part and just exploring culinary traditions that did not rely on wheat. It just turned out to be so much more fun for me and so much more gratifying to get a really good Thai cookbook and, you know, cook out of a rice-based culture where, you know, there is no soy sauce. It's all fish sauce, right? And I can have that. That's totally safe. And that's become my first piece of advice for anybody who has lost a big chunk of the food world. It's to locate that area of the world that doesn't even grow that type of food and learn as much as you possibly can about how to cook that cuisine, because it's eye-opening and it's life-changing and it's a lot of fun.
Was it hard to find a part of the world that didn't have wheat or at least something with gluten in it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it grows pretty much everywhere now. And, of course, food spreads in all kinds of ways, from, you know, imperialism to travel to just plain curiosity. But, you know, a lot of Mexican food is inherently gluten-free and a lot of fun to cook. Vietnamese, Thai, to a certain extent, certain Chinese foods. You know, I discovered little pockets of French culinary history where buckwheat blinis are really easy to substitute gluten-free. In Nice and in Italy, there's a flatbread made out of chickpea flour called socca, which turns out to be, you know, very good. And that was the direction that I went in time. It took me a long time to get there.
Mm-hmm. But this appeals to the researcher in you, it sounds like.
It does. It does. It appeals to the researcher, to the food nerd. You know, all of those culinary encyclopedias that I have became very useful as I started to sleuth my way through. And yet, I never forgot about bread. I never did. And we kept trying to bake loaves in the house, and there were some catastrophic failures, and there were some just, you know, inedible products that came out of our oven.
Uh-huh.
And we ultimately graduated from some reliable bagged mixes to some recipes from America's Test Kitchen, who happened to be working on the same problem that I was working on at about the same time.
So is there a kind of bread that you could finally get to?
Yeah, we have a local gluten-free bakery now. It seems miraculous, but they opened it just as I was starting to write the end of the book. They gave me a beautiful ending for the book.
Oh, great.
I couldn't have contrived that any better. But, yeah, there are some bagged mixes that I love, and we do bake some loaves at home as well.
All right, let's take a call here. We have Hollis in Arcata on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Graham, the author of In Memory of Bread.
Hi, Paul. Very interesting show. I also have been diagnosed with celiac about 12 years now, and I eat out a lot, and often I have gotten gluten, which is disastrous consequences. But I have found some gluten enzymes that if I take them when I know I've eaten some soy sauce, for instance, that has wheat in it instead of tamari, mm-hmm. that's something easily to be caught up on, too, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
If you can take these enzymes, there are gyro enzymes for gluten digestion. Get them in any natural food store, and I believe there's Enzymedia makes some as well. They really help. So wanted to pass on a couple of tips.
So when you have something you shouldn't have eaten, you can take those?
Yes.
Okay.
It really helps if you know immediately. And I find I have problems eating like in a Chinese or a Japanese restaurant. Mm-hmm. Always have to have soy, not soy sauce, but tamari, which is not wheat. does not contain wheat. Mm-hmm. So be very careful with that. And I don't even eat in Chinese restaurants anymore.
All right, thanks.
So let me just ask the caller a question.
Sure.
When you take those enzymes, do you know whether or not it actually prevents the antibodies from activating in your gut, or does it just make you feel better and make you better able to tolerate what it is you've eaten?
Well, I have not done that research. I just know that I don't throw up. And, you know, often, like 40 minutes to an hour and a half later, I'll be retching if I've had gluten. Is that your experience as well?
No, I tend not to throw up, thank God. It's usually other things that happen to me.
It does help me. I've used it often, and it helps a lot. I mean, not if I'm certainly not going to eat a whole piece of bread,
sure.
You know, something, but if there's a little gluten in something I ate, it will help if I take them soon enough. So it's just a handy thing. I mean, I travel with them. I have them in my handbag all the time.
Okay, thanks for sharing the story. Appreciate that. Have you had moments when you accidentally ate something with gluten in it and realized right away that there was a problem?
Yeah, I have. Mm-hmm. I have. And it always shows up in a place where I don't expect it to show up. Like, for instance, gluten can work its way into sausages and salami and that kind of thing. So if you eat a processed meat off of the grill or something like that or a hot dog, you're testing your luck there. Mm. But the caller raises a great point, which is that, you know, you can control for all the variables at home. And when you go to a friend's house and they're looking out for you, you can trust that you're safe. But to have a food sensitivity, whether it's celiac disease or, I don't know, a peanut allergy or, you know, something like that, and to eat out is an entirely different situation. You really do come to experience just how much of having somebody prepare your food for you is an implicit extension of trust.
You
can't see into the kitchen. You can't see what people are doing. You don't know whether the surface is clean. You don't know exactly what went into it because no good menu tells all of its secrets, right? And you can ask, and, you know, you can be reassured, but there is always, when I go out, that moment, unless it's a place that I know very well, where I ask myself, well, am I going to be okay? That's here. Here we go.
Let's take another call. Here's Linda in Little River, California. Welcome to The Exchange with Paul Gray. I'm the author of In Memory of Bread.
Yes, hi. I'm so glad to hear this subject being put out on the radio, and I really appreciate your writing the book, which I'm going to get. I lost 30 pounds in 4 years and was down to 90 pounds and could see my ribs on the front and of my body and the back. And I wondered, have you heard of the specific carbohydrate diet and the book Breaking the Vicious Cycle by Elaine Gotchel, which is the diet that I have to follow in order to stay well? And I gained back that 30 pounds, but it's taken me 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for the question.
The other thing I just wanted to mention is when I saw Dr. Gary Gray at Stanford University, I asked him how much gluten would affect me, and he told me it would fit on the end of a pencil. And I have found that to be true when just even eating a bulk peanut butter, I, like the previous caller, it makes me nauseated and throw up.
Okay, thanks for the observations there, Linda. Appreciate that. So the specific carbohydrate diet, I mean, imagine you ran across a bunch of things in your travels, Paul.
I did. I mean, there's all kinds of diets out there. There's elimination diets, and there's challenges that you can go on. There's the FODMAPs diet, which is, I think, like the specific carbohydrate diet. There's a lot of people also go paleo. And, you know, the paleo diet is meant to mimic, you know, pre-Neolithic revolution eating practices. Essentially, if it doesn't walk, fly, swim, crawl, or grow out of the ground, you don't eat it. And I just never really felt tempted to try any of them. And I might be different from a lot of people in that regard. My own thinking was, okay, I've had to compromise this much. I'm not compromising any further. And I'm just going to have faith that if I take pretty good care of myself, really good care of myself, eventually I will be able to enjoy everything that I used to enjoy, with the exception of this one group of foods. And so far, it's turned out to be true.
Have you put the weight back on that you lost when you were at your sickest?
Yeah, that and then some. but But I think I had always been, you know, like the last caller, I'd always been on the lean side of healthy. And if I think back through, you know, the last 10, 15 years, maybe even further back than that, you know, I can see how I was probably not absorbing everything that I was taking into my body.
So what of the foods that you loved that were not, that we'd assume anyway, would not be a gluten problem, can you eat? Can you have, for example, the innards of a Reuben sandwich without having the bread that surrounds it?
Yeah, I can, but why would I? I mean, I guess I could. Yeah, but you need the bread, don't you? I can have just about everything that I used to have. And, you know, we do things now like Korean-styled barbecue, right, where instead of a bun, we'll wrap a burger up in a huge piece of leaf lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
And that works out fine. We do sliders that way. There's a restaurant that we love in Burlington that, you know, the first time we went there and had, you know, just meat on a bed of really well-prepared greens, we thought, okay, this is really good, and this is something that we can do at home. It's just, you know, the social experience of bread and something about the smell of it and the process of making it that just is so hard to forget and so hard to compromise on. So, you know, everything except for that, I guess.
So just about a minute left here. The social response from people, I mean, everybody probably mm-hmm. wants to take
yeah.
care of you and all that stuff. Did you finally get to a point where you could say, look, don't worry about me. I'll take care of myself.
Yeah, I think so. I still have people who I have friends who will say, you know, you probably shouldn't eat that. You shouldn't think about eating that. You shouldn't look at that. Do you know that that's safe? Are you 100% certain? And I always am. But, yeah, they still take care of me.
Okay, good to know. It's a lot of interesting stuff in the book, and it's a really impassioned defense of the things that we love and in some cases can't eat anymore. Paul Graham wrote In Memory of Bread. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me. It's a lot of fun.
All right, take care.